January the 5th, 1962, Lecture 18, Rotation in Two Dimensions. January the 5th, 1962, Lecture 18, Rotation in Two Dimensions.
Gentlemen!
The last time we were studying the mechanics of points, or small particles that you didn't see the insides of, and in this term we're going to discuss many different subjects beside mechanics. But the first four lectures or so will be on mechanics, but not of simple points, but the application of mechanics to more complicated things. And I think I promised you at the beginning that when the world became more complicated, it became more interesting. And I think you'll find that the phenomena that are associated with mechanics, when it's a more complex object that's moving around, rather than just a point, are really quite striking. They are nothing but the combinations of Newton's laws, but sometimes it takes an awful lot of courage and confidence to believe that that still comes out of F equals MA. When we deal with more complicated objects, they have several kinds of things. You could have water flowing around and galaxies whirling and all kinds of objects. We will have to study things like gas flow and water flow later. But the simplest object to analyze near the beginning is a sort of a rigid body or almost solid object that's turning. However, we'll prepare the groundwork for even more complicated circumstances. The main subject then of today's lecture is rotation. And the rotation is limited in this lecture to two dimensions. Please remember that, because the things have to be generalized, and that'll happen in the next lecture when we go to three dimensions. Unlike the case of ordinary mechanics, the rotations are sufficiently subtle that it's hard to understand it unless you first get a good solid grounding in the two dimensions. That is a rotation in a plane first, and then we'll go out of the plane. The first interesting theorem that I would like to mention about complicated objects can be seen roughly like this. If you throw something like that, it's a kind of a complicated object. And you know it goes in a parabola, because we studied all that, for a particle. But that's not a particle. That's a kind of a mess. It wobbles and it jiggles and so on. It goes in a parabola, though. You saw that. What goes in a parabola? Certainly not the point on the corner of the eraser, because that's jiggling about. And neither is it the end of the wooden stick or the middle of the wooden stick or the middle of the eraser or what. But something goes in a parabola. And there is an effective center which moves in a parabola. And so our first theorem about complicated objects is to demonstrate that there is a mean position, a kind of middle of all of this, somewhere around here, which is mathematically definable. It isn't necessarily a point of the material itself, but it's sort of in the middle somewhere, and that middle point goes exactly in a parabola. And that's called the theorem of the center of mass, and the proof of it, the demonstration of it, is given here on the first board. Suppose that we consider every object. In fact, we can understand how everything moves naturally by considering it as a sum of lots of little particles, the atoms, say, with various forces among them. Let I represent an index that talks about one of the particles. There are millions of them, so I goes to 10 to the 23rd or so. Then the force on the ith particle is, of course, the mass times the acceleration of the ith particle, which I'm taking one dimension, but you can write all these equations, x component, y component, z component, or put vectors on or whatever you want. You figure it out. You generalize it to three dimensions. But we just write x. Now, of course, since the mass is constant, oh, I forgot to say something else, that all the work we're going to talk about for the next four lectures about moving objects will be objects that are moving, in which all the parts are moving very much smaller than the speed of light, and we'll take the non-relativistic approximation to everything. So under those circumstances, the mass is constant, and this is correct. And likewise, of course, is this correct? It's the second derivative of the mass of the object times its position in the x direction. Well, now, if we add the total force on all the particles, all the forces on all the particles added together in a particular direction, you put vectors on it, that's the sum of all the FIs. That is, over all of the different indices, we add these forces, F. And if we add on the other side of the equation, then you know that you get the same thing as if you add before you differentiate. So therefore, the total force is the second derivative of the masses times their positions, added together. Now, the total force on all the particles is the same as the external force. Because although there are all kinds of forces on the particles of the eraser, because of the string and the wiggling and the pullings and pushings and the atomic forces and God knows what, and I have to add all those together, how am I going to make the calculation? Well, fortunately, we have the action and reaction are equal. So when I add all the particles together, any pair that have forces between them, it cancels out in the sum. And therefore, the net result is only those forces which arise from other particles that aren't included in the so-called, in whatever object we decide to sum over. So if this is the sum over a certain number of the particles, which we call the objects, that is, I include these things that you see, but not the air, for example, or not me, although you can work the theorem for a bigger thing, then there's the external force on the total object is equal to the sum of all the forces. Well, that's nice, so we only have to worry about the external force. Now, it would be fun if we could write that as ma. In other words, if we could write this thing as the total mass times some coordinate. Well, let's force it. Let's say m is the sum of all the masses. That's the total mass. And then if we're going to get that to be mx, you see, then if we make mx equal this sum here, which is just what we need. Then, of course, if we could do this, since the sum of the masses is a constant, this would be the second derivative of mx, and m would be a constant. M is just the total mass of the whole thing. And we would find that the external forces is the total mass times the acceleration of imaginary point whose location is capital X. And the position of the imaginary point is given by dividing these two equations. It's given this way. If you study this a bit, you'll discover that what it means is it is a point somewhere in the middle of the object. It's a kind of an average value of X in which the different X's have weights or importances proportional to the masses. So when there's more mass at a certain location, that location contributes more in the average to capital X than other masses. And it's somewhere in the middle always. We should discuss this very important theorem in more detail, and I will reserve that for a later lecture. It's really not very well organized. I should continue to describe this, but I would like to get to rotation because there are certain problems of organizing lectures. So we'll come back to this subject in more detail later. I would like to remark, however, on two points. First of all, if the external forces are zero, so if that were floating in empty space, it may whirl and twist and jiggle and do all kinds of things, but the center of gravity, this artificially invented calculated position, which is somewhere in the middle, will move if the force, total external force is zero, at constant velocity. In particular, for instance, if it's initially at rest, it'll stay at rest. So that if you have some kind of a box, a spaceship or something, with people in it and so on, and at a certain moment you figure out the center of gravity and it's standing still, and no external forces are acting on it, then the center of gravity will continue to stand still. Of course, the spaceship may go like this a little bit in space, but that's because the people are walking back and forth inside, so that when one walks toward the front, the ship goes toward the back in such a way as to keep the average position of all the masses in exactly the same position. Therefore, rocket propulsion is absolutely impossible because you can't move the center of gravity, but the only way you can do it is to cheat and decide that you only want to propel an interesting part of the rocket, the uninteresting part you throw away. In other words, if this is the rocket with zero velocity of the center of gravity, and we spit out some gas out the back end, then this little blob of gas can, this is the first picture, the gas is fuel in here. I mean, before it burned. And after the second picture, we have the object here and the gas way over here. Not much gas, but the center of gravity, if it were here before, is still exactly here, further back than where it was before because this has moved over here. So we move the part that we're interested in against the part that we're not interested in, but the center of gravity of all the stuff that we started with never changes if there's no external forces. Well, I'll come back, as I said, to the meaning and some of the importance of this center of gravity theorem, the interest of it later, but now we would like to talk about rotations. So disregarding the motion of the center of gravity, we have some kind of a thing. And I would like to limit it to the situation of motion in a plane and not worry about this at the same time as that, but we'll come up to those two things later. The first circumstance that we have to discuss is an ordinary rotation. Now, an ordinary object just doesn't rotate. It's complicated. It wobbles and it shakes and it bends and everything else. But we'll take an approximation for a while, on and off. I'll tell you when I'm making it, when I'm not. And I'll say I'm talking about a rigid body. That means an object in which the forces between the atoms are so strong and such a character that the little forces that I make to move it doesn't bend it. So that the shape stays essentially the same as it moves around. So if it's only going to move in a plane, and I'm not talking about the motion of the center of gravity, there's only one thing left for it to do, because I said it wasn't allowed to do anything else, and that's to turn. So we have to describe that. How do you describe that? Well, one way would be, we'll suppose for a while, we just don't worry about the motion of the center. There's some center here which stays put. Maybe it's the center of gravity, but it's rotating around some particular axis. Now, how can we define the rotation? It's easy enough if this is the axis marked here, and then we mark a point on the object somewhere, anywhere. There's the object. Take any point at all for a reference. It's just a label. It doesn't make any difference. Then we can always tell you exactly where the object is if I tell you only where this point has gone to. Because if this point has gone to here and I told you it was rotating around that axis, so that point's at the same place, then the object must go in here. If I tell you that this point has gone to here and the axis is still here, you'll tell me that it's not a rigid body. It had a stretch. So you must remember, of course, that in a rigid body, this radius is the same as that. So the only thing that's left to define the position is the angle. And so rotation consists of a study of the variations of the angle with time. That's all. That's what we had to get to. I mean, that's self-evident. It's a big lecture sound. So in order to talk about rotation, we talk about the angle it has turned through. Mind you, that's no particular angle in the object itself. It isn't that I'm drawing some angle on the object. I'm talking about the angular change of the position of the whole darn thing from one time to another. Now, we have to work out a few little things about such rotation. First, the kinematics of it. The angle will change with time. And just as we talked about velocity and length, in fact, there's a very interesting relationship between rotation in two dimensions and one-dimensional displacement, in which almost every quantity has its analog. And I start to make the first one is that the angle, which defines how far it's gone around, is replaces the distance, which is how far it moved along. And in the same manner, we can talk about a velocity of turning, how much the angle changes in a second, just like we talk about how fast the thing moves, how much it moves in a second. So we call this the velocity, and we call this the angular velocity. So we define the angular velocity as the limit of the changes in angle per second. If the angle is measured in what you call radians, then this angular velocity will be so and so many radians per second. And the bigger the angular velocity, the faster it's turning. I mean, the faster the angle changes, and so on. So there's nothing to it. I mean, it's exactly analogous. In the same manner, we can go on. We can differentiate again. We can differentiate the angular velocity with respect to the time, and we could call it the angular acceleration. And that would be the analog of the ordinary acceleration, only it's an angle. It's, of course, the second derivative of the angle with respect to time, and so many radians per second per second. That's all there is to the kinematics, and I don't think it, in this late stage, is worth discussing in great detail these things, which are easy enough. So they're just an analog to motion in one dimension, except, of course, when theta equals 2 pi, you're back where you were before, a circumstance which doesn't arise in displacement. If you move it 17 inches, you're not back where you were before unless the space is curved in some manner so that we ultimately do come back if we go out far enough. But we don't have any knowledge on that at the moment. There is, however, some point we have to connect our dynamics for rotation with the laws of dynamics of the particles. And so I'd like to be able to talk about how a particular particle moves here when the angular velocity is such and such. So therefore, we take a certain particle, which is located at a distance r out here, and say it's at a certain location. And then it's as the axis. And the location of the particle at a given instant was x by y in the usual manner. Now, if in a moment later, in a certain time later, delta t, the angle of the whole object has turned through delta theta, then this particle is carried with it around. It's the same radius away as it was before, but it's carried to here. And the first thing we'd like to know is how much the distance x changes and how much the distance y changes. Well, I just wrote the answer down. I didn't figure it out. If this distance is called r, then the length of this thing is r delta theta because of the way angles are defined. And the change in x, then, is simply the projection of r delta theta in this direction. So the delta x is minus, because it's coming in, a proportion of r delta theta, which proportion is the opposite over the hypotenuse of that little triangle. After you do all this triangle business, it turns out that this triangle is similar to this big one here, and that this side is to the hypotenuse is the same as this side is to this hypotenuse. That is to say, it's y over r, which is a nice and simple formula. It says, therefore, that this delta x is equal to minus y delta theta, and that delta y, if you figure it out in the same way, is plus x delta theta. So when we turn, we have here rules that tell us how much the x changes and how much the y changes for small changes. But if the thing is turning at a given angular velocity by dividing both sides of this by delta t, I would find, for instance, that the velocity in the x direction of a particle is equal to minus y times the angular velocity, and the velocity in the y direction of the particle is equal to x times the angular velocity. That means if the thing is turning with a certain angular velocity, it's going around here with some angular velocity, that means that this object has some velocity, v. And the components of this velocity, v, have we just worked out as x and y like that, times omega. If you want the magnitude of it, you can take the square root of the sum of the squares. You'll get something like x squared plus y squared, which is r squared. So it's not mysterious that the value of the magnitude of this velocity is omega r. It checks out, and the speed of it is omega times r. And that's self-evident because the distance that it moves is r delta theta. So the distance it moves per second is r delta theta delta t, or r omega. And that's very easy, that the speed of an object at a radius r when it's turning at angular velocity omega is omega r. And the components are given here of the two components, x and y. Now, therefore, we have gone up to this. We've got the kinematics. Now, the next step is to go at the dynamics. And in the case of dynamics, there's a new concept that starts the analysis, which is force. And so the question is whether or not we can invent something, which we will invent, it turns out, or I wouldn't have bothered to waste your time, which we'll call the torque, which bears the same relationship to rotation as force does to movement. Now, a force against a movement is a push that way, and a thing that you need to make something rotate is that's a torque. This kind of a thing, huh? That's a torque. All right? Now, that's a torque qualitatively. Let's get a torque quantitatively. The best way to make the theory, to get to the theory of torques quantitatively, is to study the work done in turning an object. You see, one way of defining a force very nicely, without having any directions involved, is to say, how much work do I do when I move the force this way? The work that you do is the force times the distance you move it. We're going to try to maintain that law for angles. We're going to try to say that the work that we do when we turn something a little bit, when there are forces acting on it, is the force times the angle, is the torque times the angle it turns through. In other words, the definition of the torque is going to be so arranged that the theorem of work has its absolute analog, that the force times the distance is the work, and the torque times the angle is going to be the work. So that tells us what the torque is. And we can consider, for instance, a rigid body of some kind with various forces acting on it. and an axis. And I'll take for a moment the simple example that there's only, well, one force, say. But you have a lot of forces. It doesn't make any difference. Put a sum sign in front. Let's suppose there are several forces acting at points on air. Now, well, we'll concentrate on one. Suppose that this thing, this force is applied at a certain point. This particular force is applied at a point x, y. How much work would be done if I were to turn the object through a very small angle? Well, that's easy. The work done is the force in the x direction times the change in x plus the force in the y direction times the change in y. Well, I went through an awful lot of trouble over here to find the changes in x and the changes in y when I turned something for this purpose, really. And so I only need to substitute that in here, and I'll find out the following. Since delta y is x delta theta, I like to take the plus 1 first so that the answer comes out with starting with a positive sign. I get f y delta theta for this term. And for this term, I get minus y f sub x delta theta, which incidentally is x f sub y minus y f sub x times delta theta. That is that the amount of work that we've done is in fact proportional to the angle through which we've turned it, but by a funny business with the force and the distances and God knows what. And this funny business we'll call the torque. So that the change in work will be the torque times angle. And now we have the relation to formula for torque in terms of forces. In other words, torque is not a new idea and completely independent of Newtonian mechanics. Torque has a definite definition in terms of the force, namely this definition. Now, it looks kind of hard to see what the meaning of this combination of x, f sub x, f sub y minus y f sub x is, but well, I'll talk about it in just a minute. I want to talk about the case now when there are several forces. When there are several forces acting, the work that's done is the sum of the works done by all the forces. And so the change in work will be a whole lot of terms all added together for all the forces, each of which is proportional, however, to delta theta. So I can take the delta theta out. And therefore, I can have this way, that the change in the work is equal to the sum of all the torques. The sum of all the different forces, all the different ones that are acting, of the torque from each one times delta theta. And this I might call the total torque, so that the torques add just by addition. Don't forget that's only because we're working in a plane. It's like one-dimensional kinematics, where the forces simply add by addition. But it's not, it's for one angle. We're going to get more complicated in three dimensions. This, then, is the total torque acting on the object. Then the total torque times delta theta is this. And if you want a more complete expression, the total torque is the sum for all the forces of x times f of y minus y times f of x for all the forces. The reason I bring that up is I want to get free of charge a theorem. And the theorem that I want to get free of charge is that if an object is in equilibrium, with all the forces, if all the forces leave it in balance, that the total of all the torques is zero. Because if an object is in equilibrium, no work is done by a small displacement. So the delta W is zero, and if the displacement is delta theta, and therefore the sum of all the torques must be zero. So one of the conditions of equilibrium, beside the condition that the sum of the forces is zero, is that the sum of the torques is zero. All right, now let's tackle the question of what this looks like more carefully. Go back to one force and try to figure out geometrically what this thing amounts to. This was the work done by the rotating object. So we can also figure it out a much more direct way. Here's the point. And let's suppose this is the force acting in this direction. And the object is rotated through a small angle from here to here. What is the work done? Well, you know that the only thing that counts is the component that, let's put the order of force this way, is the component of force in the direction of the displacement. In other words, it's only the component of the force in this direction that counts. And this must be multiplied by the distance. If this is r and this is delta theta, this distance is r delta theta. And therefore, you see that the torque is also equal to the tangential component of the force, like tangential, I mean at perpendicular to the radius, this way, times the radius. In other words, if a thing is pulling this way, the torque is only the part of the force which is going this way. And that is loaded by how far out it is. Now, that's got a lot of sense compared to our idea of the torque, because if the force were completely radial, if I pull this way, I don't put any twist on it. So it's evident that the twisting effect should be only involve the part of the force which isn't pulling out from the center. And that means just this component, so that's right. Now, it's furthermore clear that if I push, I can get do much more work with a given force on a long arm than if I try the same force very near the axis. I hardly get any effect. In fact, take the case where I push right on the axis. I'm not twisting at all. I get more of a twist the further out I push my force. And so that the amount of twist or torque is proportional to the radial distance and the tangential component of the force. It makes good sense. I'll let you play with the geometry to prove that this formula is exactly the same as this, but it's just a question of taking angles and fooling around. It's the same. They're two different formulas for exactly the same thing. And there's still a third formula for the same thing, which is very interesting. You see, it's the force times the radius times the sine of this angle in here, if you figure it out, because that's what you need to make this projection. But a very amusing thing is if you draw a straight line here and draw this line down from here to here, which is the perpendicular distance to the line of action of the force, which we sometimes call the lever arm of the force, not this distance, but the distance on the line. That's just this is the lever arm. Then you see that this, by similar triangles, you hope you sit down and figure the angles out. This is shorter than this by just the right proportion, as the tangential part of the force is shorter than the total force. And the formula for the torque can also be written, I'll let you check all this, as the total force in magnitude, the magnitude of the force, times the lever arm. That is, what counts is how far out the force is in its effect when you run it back through the origin. That's just the same thing in another way. But it's good to get some idea of the meaning of the torque. Now, there's also some other words. So because of this idea that it's the force but weighed or strengthened or multiplied by how far out it is, the more effective the force is as far as the torque is concerned when it's further out, this is sometimes called technically the moment of the force. So you may want to see those words somewhere. Torque is called the moment of the force. Why moment means weighed by how far it is out, I don't know, but that's what it means. I don't know where the word ever came from. But moment means weighed by how far away it is from an axis. So the moment of force is also the torque, is the same thing. That has to do with the definition of torque from work and the general definitions of properties of the formula. It's also the same as Fy times x minus y of x. They're all the same. And that had to do with a rigid body. Nevertheless, the properties of torques and their mathematical relationships are interesting also, even when an object is not rigid. And I want to show you a very remarkable theorem. The force is the rate of change of a quantity p, which we call the momentum. Will it turn out that the analogy is so close that not only is there a torque belonging to the force, but there's some kind of a thing that represents how fast it's going around, sort of, but going around, not the amount of inertial nyah that it's got when it's coasting forward, the momentum, but the amount of inertial nyah it's got because it's spinning. And the answer is there is, and we'll call it L, and we'll show that it is, and we'll find the formula for it. So disregard, now I'm not talking only about rigid bodies anymore, but completely in general, we'll suppose that there's a system on which there's some forces, and find out what happens to what, and see if we can find an angular momentum. First, of course, the thing to do is to take one object. Here's one particle, mass m. And here's an axis. And it's not necessarily rotating. It's moving, say, an ellipse. It's a planet or something going around the sun or anything. It's moving somehow or other. And there are forces on it. And it accelerates, and it goes the usual formula that the x component of force is the mass times the x component of the acceleration, yin, yang, yang, yang. But let's see what the torque equals. The torque ought to equal the rate of change, if I'm lucky, of the angular momentum, I hope. You see, I'm trying to get the analog of the formula that the force is the rate of change with time of the momentum, more specifically in one direction. More specifically, this is for rotation in a plane, but I said that at the beginning, so don't forget, we'll take care of three dimensions later. One dimension's hard enough. So here we are with wanting a formula, something like this. Well, we can't get what we want just like that. I mean, what the torque equals isn't something we can just, we start with more honesty. The torque equals x times f sub y minus y times f sub x. And when the forces act on the particle, the force in the y direction is the mass times the acceleration in the y direction. And the mass, the force in the x direction is the mass times the acceleration in the x direction. So this is what it is. Well, that doesn't look like the derivative with respect to time of anything simple. And if it isn't, we're not going to get anywhere. So is it or isn't it? It doesn't look like it, but remarkably enough, it is. Look, suppose that you were to take the derivative with respect to time of the following quantity, x m dy dt minus y m dx dt, just for fun. I mean, how did I know that this was the right quantity to take? I studied mechanics when I was a freshman, too. Now, differentiate this thing. Oh, it's terribly difficult. There's a product in here. Now we can differentiate product. You differentiate, first of all, this is really a constant. So we don't have to worry about that. That'll come through like water through a sieve. That's a better analogy. Instead of saying like water through a sieve, you can say like a constant through a differential sign. Okay. Now, now that's sophisticated. Now we differentiate this product. And first we differentiate the first term and leave the second term alone. That gives dx dt dy dt. This is from the first term. Now, the second term that comes from just differentiating this is obtained by differentiating that. That's x times the second derivative of y with respect to t. These two pieces come from this one piece. Likewise, there will be two pieces that will come from this one piece. And what will they be? Well, let's not get fogged up in all this stuff. This piece here is obviously what we want. That's lovely. This thing here is dirt that we don't want. On the other hand, look what's going to come in the dirt position over there. dy dt times dx dt. And that's the same as this. So the dirts go out, right? So that's why it's good. I mean, otherwise I wouldn't bother with showing it to you. So there it is true that the torque is the rate of change with time of something. And so we pay attention to the something. We give it a name. We call it L. We erase this horrible line through here and say, la, we do have such a thing. And we even have a formula for L. And I'll write it. L is equal. And if you'll let me write, this is L right here. This is L. This. But I'm going to make one more step in it because it seems funny. Look, m dy dt, you know what that is? That's the momentum in the y direction. And so I'm going to write it in a nice way. It's x times the momentum in the y direction minus y times the momentum in the x direction. That's what it is. The reason I did that was, although the proofs have nothing to do with relativity, I like to give you the formula to remember in a way that's true in general. Huh? And it's true in general this way, even if the masses change. But never mind all that fancy business. This is the L. This is the angular momentum in terms of the momentum. And so you see a nice that we do have such a thing to go with the momentum. And what is it? Well, just like the force was given by this formula here, and we wrote a whole lot of other formulas for the force, so we have this formula for the angular momentum. And by just analogy, geometry, or whatever you want to call it, you can figure out what it is in other forms. Example. the particle is going around this way. It is moving, say, this way. It has a certain momentum. Let that be the momentum vector. Now I want to know what the angular momentum is around this axis. Answer, this. Or, take only the component of the momentum that's tangential and multiply it by the radius. So also, it's the tangential component of the momentum times the radius. In other words, the only thing that counts for angular momentum is nothing to do with how fast it's going away from the origin, but only the part of the fact that it's going around the origin. Only the tangential part of the momentum counts for angular momentum. Furthermore, the further it is out, the more the angular momentum. If there's a weight that's very far out, it's harder to swing it around. It's got more inertia for turning than a weight that's closer in. We'll do a demonstration in a minute. So you see that the inertia depends on how far out it is as well as what momentum it has. Incidentally, also because of the geometrical facts are the same, whether the thing is labeled P or F, it's also true that there's a lever arm. It's not the same as a lever arm of the force. You see, each lever arm depends on the vector whose lever arm you're supposed to take. It depends. And you draw the line of the momentum back, and you find the distance there. So you can also say it's the magnitude of the momentum times the lever arm, but it's not the lever arm of the force. It's the momentum lever arm, of course. It's also the same angular momentum. So you have three formulas, just like you have three formulas for the other. Well, I now would like to talk not about a single object. I have some difficulty having organized this lecture, so I'll have some of these things I'll come back to in a little bit better detail later. But let's take the case not of a single, I'll do one case with a single object. And we'll do the following case. Suppose that a planet is going around the sun. Under those circumstances, which direction is the force? The force is in the direction toward the sun. What, then, is the torque on the object? The torque is the force times the lever arm zero. Or the torque is the component of force perpendicular to the... There isn't any. There's no torque. Therefore, the angular momentum of the thing going around the sun must remain constant. So let's see, what does that mean? That means that if at a moment it's moving somehow, I haven't got quite enough room to draw the velocity. Well, yeah, let it come. All right, yeah, there's the velocity, up there somewhere. I'll draw a better picture. In a given moment, that the component of velocity this way, the tangential component of the velocity, times the mass, that's the momentum in that direction, times the radius, will be constant. Because that's the angular momentum, and the rate of change of the angular momentum is the torque, and in this problem, the torque is zero. Believe it or not, the center of gravity of all that chalk moved in accordance with the total force on all the pieces. Now, that's a complicated force, though. Now, this is a constant if there was no torque, and there is no torque. Of course, the mass is also a constant, so in practice, it means only that the tangential velocity times the radius is a constant. It's interesting to see what that means. I want to show you that that's something you already knew for the motion of a planet. Because suppose you consider a small amount of time, delta t. How far will a planet move? It moves from here to here. But how much area will it sweep through? Well, disregarding the very tiny area compared to the much longer area here, it's simply this base times the height. In other words, the area that's swept through will be equal to the radius times this distance, which is the velocity that's tangential times the time. So that the area change in a given time is proportional to the angular momentum, but that's constant. That means that in equal amounts, delta t, the changes in area are equal. So equal areas in equal times is a word description of the statement of the law of conservation of angular momentum. And plus that there's no torque produced by the force, so that the total angular momentum stays constant. The angular momentum, then, is the mass times the rate of change of area per second. And so equal areas in equal time is a consequence of that. Now, that's pretty far. We've gone pretty far. I want one more thing. I have to talk about what happens when there is a large number of parts, when an object is made like that nutty thing that I threw up of pieces. All over a whole lot of pieces, that is found. When an object is made of a whole lot of pieces, there is a whole lot of forces acting and a lot of parts. Now we would be able to deduce, of course, that around any axis, the torque on the ith particle, which you know is the force on the ith particle times the lever arm of that force, so on, is equal to the rate of change of the angular momentum of the ith particle. And the angular momentum of the ith particle is the momentum of the ith particle times its radial distance, tangential component, and so on. So this is true. But now suppose we add it for all the particles together and call it the total torque. Then this will be the rate of change of the sum of all the particles, Li. And that defines a new thing, which we'll call total L, or just L, total, the total angular momentum. We know about total momentum of an object is the sum of all the parts. And so the total angular momentum is the sum of the angular momentum of all the parts. Now, the rate of change of the total L then is the total torque. Well, the total torque is a complicated thing. There's all those internal actions and all these forces and everything else. But if we take Newton's law of action and reaction to say this, that the action and reaction are equal and directed exactly opposite along the same line, which is what he said, or should have said if he didn't. I haven't been able to find it in Newton, actually, but he somewhere tacitly assumes it. In other words, if between two particles the forces are not only equal, but opposite, they'll be directed along the same line. See, this doesn't satisfy the condition. That's not action equal reaction. They have to be directed in the same line. Then the two torques, the torque on this object produced by that, and the torque of that object produced on this will be equal and opposite, because the lever arms from any axis are equal. So their torques balance out. Internal torques balance out. And so we have the remarkable theorem that the rate of change of the total angular momentum is only equal to the external torques. There, now we're getting somewhere. Because what we need, of course, is a theorem for big objects that we don't have to look at the internal machinery. And here's a theorem for big objects that the external torque is the rate of change of the total angular momentum. Now, I'd like to try to demonstrate some of these things. I guess I'm not supposed to yet. I have to prove something else. And the time is running out, but I'll try. One case of importance that we have to work with is to find the total angular momentum for a rigid object, that is, an object of a definite shape that's just turning around. Suppose that there's an object that's fixed in its dimensions in geometry, which is rotating around, so that there are various parts of the object bear with one another all the same relationship. Now let's try to find the total angular momentum of all the parts. If the mass of one of the objects is mi and its position, its location is at xi, yi, then the problem is to find the angular momentum of that, because the total angular momentum is the sum of them all. The angular momentum of the ith one will be the momentum, the mass rather, times the velocity in the y direction of the ith, it's x times the mass times the velocity in the y direction minus y times the mass times the velocity in the x direction of the ith particle. That's just the same thing we set up here. But the velocities we had worked out on a blackboard, which is now lost. No, it's here. Down, boy. Here's the velocity in the x direction, minus y omega. So this thing is minus yi omega. And this one, in turning, the velocity in the y direction is x omega. And therefore, we find out that this is mi times xi squared plus yi squared times omega. That is, for an object going around in a circle, The angular momentum is the mass times the square of the distance from this axis times omega. And if there's a lot of objects going around in a solid body, so they all have the same omega, then by adding this equation, we find that we can write that the angular momentum is equal to something or other times omega. And the something or other is the sum for all of the particles of the mass of each times the square of the distance from the axis. So, this is the analog of the law that momentum is mass times velocity. Velocity is replaced by angular velocity, and you see the mass is replaced by this new thing which we call the moment of inertia. Why, I don't know. That's the thing that's analogous to the mass. It says that a thing has inertia for turning, which depends not for turning, not just on the masses, but on how far away they are from the axis. So that if you take two objects of the same mass, and one of them you put the masses further away from the axis, the inertia for turning will be higher. And this is demonstrated by this piece of equipment. There's a weight which is kept from going down too fast because it has to turn this thing around. But you see how fast the thing speeds up. Now, the next time, I'm not going to change anybody's weight. All the weights will be the same. And the only thing I'm going to change is the moment of inertia by changing the distance away from the axis. You saw how fast it speeded up that time. And now we'll take the same proposition out here, where the two masses are much further away from the axis, so that the inertia, which goes as the square of the distance, is much higher. Then you see that it starts up much slower than it did before, because it has a lot more inertia against turning. A moment of inertia is inertia against turning, and is the sum of the contributions of all the masses times the distance squared from the axis. There is, therefore, one very important difference, which is very delightful, in fact, between mass and moment of inertia. The mass of an object never changes, but the moment of inertia of an object can be changed. I mean, I could have a certain moment of inertia and then move myself in. Say, my arms are further out, the weights are out, I bring the weights in. Then to change the square of the distance, not the mass, I change the moment of inertia. And therefore, all kinds of wonderful things will happen. For example, let's consider the law of the conservation of angular momentum in a circumstance where a thing changes its moment of inertia from one value to another, and under circumstances where there are no torques. If the torque is zero, that's the external torque, I mean, is the rate of change of the total angular momentum. That's the rate of change of the moment of inertia times omega. Suppose I take two circumstances where a thing is going around, there's never any external torque going. At a certain instant initial condition, it's going around with a big moment of inertia at a low angular velocity, omega 1. That's the angular momentum. And then I change the moment of inertia by pulling myself together, say. Then this product, which has to stay the same because the total angular momentum has to stay the same. So after the ball is over, or after I've changed my inertia, I will have I2, and I have to have a new omega 2 so that these two are equal. Thus, if I reduce the moment of inertia, I have to increase the angular velocity. And so we've got a little table here to sit on, a chair to sit on, which has the feature that no torque can be exerted around the vertical axis because it's frictionless, nearly. And I'm going to start out and give myself a lot of moment of inertia by taking, beside my own moment of inertia, the moment of inertia, these two weights, I can't hold them out very long, held out. So I have a big moment of inertia. Then I pull the two weights in, and I'll reduce my moment of inertia, and of course the theory says I'll go around faster. So we'll see if it's true. So we see. If I go around too fast, I fall over. So I put the weights out here, and I start to go around. And then I pull them in, you see, and I do go faster, and then I slow up when I go to low moment of inertia and speed up at high. And slow. All right? Wait a minute. Lecture isn't over yet. Lecture isn't over. However, it really is over. There's another point that there's another little thing I want to tell you about. This is all the lectures I've been giving you so far are, as best of my ability, all true. What I have to say now may or may not be true. It's up to you to figure out. I want you to pay strict attention and use all your powers of observation as a scientist to deduce what the hell is going on. Now, what happened was that some man from Texas, always getting letters, and this guy from Texas sends a letter that he's got a device. In fact, some of the fellows showed me one similar gadget when I went to eat at one of the houses one time. He's got a device for lifting itself up by its own bootstraps. So I explained to them, so it would be very useful, you see, for rocket ships. You put it in the rocket, you don't have to spit anything out the back. It just drives the rocket forward, see. So I explain about the center of gravity theorem and the conservation of momentum and God knows what. And he just writes back something about, you academic people, you're so sure of your theorems and all this stuff, you never look at the real design. Furthermore, the guy calls it the great self-propelling machine with capital letters, capital G, capital S, capital P, capital M. So it's the great self-propelling machine. Well, anyway, this great inventor, capital G, capital I, we had several letters back and forth, and it's getting nowhere, and I'm telling him anyway it isn't going to work, and he says, well, you better build it, and I don't want to build it, but you know how those things are. He's in oil over there, he knows somebody in oil, and it works its way around, it comes through the trustees that it would be a good idea if we did show this guy's thing up, that it didn't really work, and so we had to make the thing. So Charlie Enders, under the direction of Nayer, built this thing in exact specifications according to the drawings that this man sent. And so we have built this self-propelling, the great self-propelling machine, which we'll bring in. Here's the machine. That's the machine. You figure out what's in it. Hear it? Oh. Wait, we have to finish it. It has to be assembled. That's what the designer indicated. Right, you take it, or I'll take it. So, take it easy now. Handle it light now. Control it. So I get on here, and I show you that it propels me. If I turn it this way, it makes me go around, you see. And if I stop, it stops. And if I turn it this way, it makes me go around again. Now, you may not believe this. You may think that these silly fins that you see here have nothing to do with it. Hey, take it easy. So we'll turn the fins around. We'll take them off the front. And put them on the back. Incidentally, look at the design of this. But Charlie Enders is an excellent machinist. So the tapes are coming off here. So we put it on the back. And of course, it ought to be the other way around now, but we'll see. It's really the fins that do it. It's a hard thing to handle here. Oh, there it goes. It's the same fins. I see the laughter isn't so great now. You're really worried about it. Now, we tried to estimate the force. The man said his machine gave 80% of its weight. This seems to be more like 60 or 50 or something. And so have you got it? All right, there. You see, it holds itself up. It really works. Well, I mean, what else do you want? It's hard to balance it. Now, your problem is to figure out what's in that box. We won't tell you what's in the box, but you'll have all the permission you want to study it. Great, you'll have these fins for careful study if you want to figure out how it worked. Thank you very much. yeah. Listen, that's a delicate machine. Now, put that down.
What? That's in my head.
Well, that...
Boy! The other
what?
I have a question, Doc.
Maybe it's not a question. Maybe I just was writing it down. But see, where, how did you get... Oh, delta X is O.
No, this one went to here. And this one went to here. Because delta Y is X delta theta, that's
oh,
all.
I see. Oh, okay, that's where I was.
Can we put that box in the crib and take it to the hotel and give it to a bellboy?
Well, that's possible. Do you know what's in the box and exactly what happened? I see. Figure it out when you...
Very nice, Dick. Pretty obvious that you have a Dean drive in the box. Yeah. And all you do is you invent a Dean drive.
Dean drive, yeah, that's right.
A little steam jet.
That's the, Dean is the great inventor.
Yeah, great inventor, Dean.
Capital G, capital I.
I'll show you what's inside next time.
Maybe you guys want to talk to me.
No.
I wanted to ask
yeah,
you.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you something. Thank you. Yeah, the great self-propelling. I got all quiet with the
yeah,
damn thing.
Yeah.
It was all going all right until I turned the fins around.
Right.
They were quiet, you know.
Do you mind if we, in the writing this up, change these things here?
What? I got this out of the book.
What book? Well,
the textbook
no,
used
no,
L. I was going to use
well,
J.
Oh, well, I wish you had.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. I would prefer to call this L.
Oh, no. Let's not do that.
Well, but in any case, I would like to use what the IUPAP committee recommends.
Oh, and what is... What do they use, L?
I think they use L.
Well, that's bad because
L
that...
Bad?
Well, it's very bad. I should have found out before, because we call this L, and that's just going to throw them off now. I can change one of them. The book, I was going to call it J.
Yeah.
And I had written my notes with J, and I looked in
the
book.
The T, really
tension.
Tension for kinetic energy. You're going to
temperature.
Want to have kinetic energy for rotating bodies.
Oh.
And you don't want to have KE all over the place.
All right. Well, they use tau in the book.
But what's wrong with that?
Well, it's only that I, unfortunately, it would have been all right if you had started me on it, but it's
yeah,
unfortunate
well,
that
we should have got together sooner.
I'm sorry, I didn't think about that problem.
Yeah.
We'll talk some more about
it. Well, I don't think we're so far
yeah.
into it.
Yeah. On the calculation L total, how would you calculate what I was?
Just adding the masses times the distances from the axis. We'll talk about that, how to do it in practice later.
Oh, I wondered
yeah.
how it was bothering you.
Take each mass and multiply by the square of the distance and add them together.
Yeah, but it should
have to integrate, of course, in a real
object. Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
I
didn't have time that, because I wanted to show this damn fool thing at the end. And I didn't quite time it right. Huh? Yeah, because you'd be still worrying about it.
I don't know. Do
you understand how it worked?
Yeah,
fair. Well, how did it work when I held it like this that I went around?
Well, you've got, well, let's see, the gyroscope.
Yeah, exactly. You sit it, figure it out. You see, if you figure it in detail, instead of saying, oh, I know, it's just a gyroscope or something, that's a different story.
But just figure in detail what happened. Then you'll learn something.
I mean, in detail, what was in there, which way was it held, why was I able to turn the fins around, and so on. That's all. It's a question.